This is a HeadGum Podcast.
This episode of the podcast is brought to you by the Fine Dining Podcast. Caroline, do you like to dine finely?
I do, because it rhymes with my name.
Caroline, dine fine, drinking water, drinking wine.
With Diane Feinstein.
With Diane Feinstein. RIP. Fine Dining, the search for the most mediocre restaurant in America, is a podcast where comedian Michael Ornelas is traveling the country, eating at all the chain restaurants in search of the perfectly average 5 out of 10 dining experience. The objective middle threshold of where bad becomes good, which, if you listen to this podcast, you're very familiar with the concept.
With a 5 out of 10 experience.
And bad maybe becoming good, as God saves us. Recently, featured guests include Marissa Pinson and John Glover as they review Costco's Food Court. It's a two-part episode that covers everything from discontinued menu items to how many hot dogs could fit in their mouths. And today, his IHOP episode dropped. So right now, head over to linktree.com/finediningpodcast and click Bee's Giveaway to enter for an all-expenses-paid trip to your local Applebee's, the current frontrunner for the most mediocre restaurant in America at a 5.02 out of 10 for you and three of your friends. And you can watch or listen to Fine Dining on your platform of choice while you're there. Caroline, who would you take?
Oh my gosh. If I got a table for four at Applebee's.
Yeah.
Obviously, love of my life, Nathan, gonna be there.
My fingers are crossing.
Who likes chain restaurants?
Oh, I'm getting a nosebleed.
Oh, probably my friend, Jeremy.
Oh,
okay.
I know him.
That leaves one more. Let me ask you a question,
yeah,
Kevin.
Yeah.
If you were gonna order an Applebee's right now, what would you get?
I'd get a fried onion if they had it.
All right, you're in.
Okay.
As long as we can share.
Hell yeah. Listen to Fine Dining on your platform of choice while you're there. Enter by May 1st, and the winner will be announced on the May 8th Chipotle episode. That's linktree.com/finediningpodcast. We listened to Almost There by Pedro the Lion, and we're going to talk about it today on Good Christian Fun.
My butthole's tingling all the time!
Do you think you can make God laugh?
No, bitch.
Little mischievous boy.
You're a clown if you say fuck.
I'm a Christian wife.
Sicario.
I'm a Christian wife.
White women are notoriously shifty.
I'm a Christian wife.
You should be upset that I had a laugh with her.
Clean up on aisle butt.
Dr. Anthony Fauci. My name is Dr. Anthony Fauci. And there's a million things I haven't cured. But just you wait. Just you wait. Dr. Anthony Fauci.
Welcome to Good Christian Fun. I'm Kevin.
I'm Caroline.
And we are the number one Dr. Anthony Fauci fan cast.
Fauci stands.
On the Apple Podcasts iTunes charts. It's definitely something that's a net positive for the world. The stan culture around political leaders, bureaucrats, and politicians is only going to be good for our society and for our values going forward.
Never grouchy when I think of Fauci.
Hey, he's no slouchy. We love Fauci. A lot of re-election.
Free slogans. He doesn't. Yeah, no, slogans. He doesn't run for office.
You goodness. Know what? Because he's a career politician. You know what that means, right?
Deep fucking state.
FTM. Follow the money. Good Christian Fun is the podcast where we talk about Christian pop culture, the music, the movies, and the entertainment made for and made by Christians, but we're not here to make fun of you or to make you go to church, or we're just here to play a cappella members parodies of Dr. Anthony Fauci set to the Hamilton soundtrack.
Sort of to like both sides every argument, you know.
We love to cover our bases and be like, well, I don't mean to offend them, but I don't mean to offend them either, and just like really break our backs doing it.
Yeah, it's good. It's that one-stop shop.
It's a one-stop shop for that. But today, the topic is, we're not talking about Fauci. We're talking about Pedro. Pedro the Lion. It's a band, not a guy. Now, Caroline, upon just seeing the artist title, did you think, okay, who's Pedro?
You know, I'm ashamed to say that I truly, not until this moment, I didn't think about what the band title meant or who Pedro is or anything. I think, if anything, like the light memory of Napoleon Dynamite crossed my mind, and then that was gone, and that's kind of where I left it.
Okay. Oh, wow. Wait, vote for Pedro?
Yeah. More election talk, though. We don't need to get into that.
Wow, I know. I'm sorry. That's actually the most toxic election of our lifetimes is when...
the Vote for Pedro boys.
Like Wes Anderson adjacent children would wear Vote for Pedro shirts in Kingwood High School in Texas. But, you know, we can't talk about this man and this band alone. We need help from a very special guest. I love the magic of podcasting. Friends and folks, he's an author, he's an artist, and guess what? He's a therapist too. Everyone, give it the hell up for Jeff Newberg! I should have said out with the old Berg and with the new Berg, and I do regret that. I apologize really for that part.
Yeah. Thanks so much for having me, guys, and what a welcome. Yeah.
Thanks
not,
for
not
being
that I'm not used to the regular bits of the show, but it's so nice to have it directed in this direction.
Yeah, is that, I mean, you've said you've listened to the show before. Is it unsettling when the people are yelling it at you? Is that
triggering? No, it's what I've been, you know, the performing artist in me is just, you know, yes, more. More.
Absolutely.
Is there an award? Is there something in Chrome?
I have
about
5 minutes prepared, but how much time do I need to fill?
we did do the GC Effies starting this year, so maybe give out some Effies next year for like best guest, best segment, all that stuff.
For your consideration, Caroline Ely, best co-host of the pod.
As long as we can destroy whatever fun or creativity we might have during this time together and focus me on competition, I'm happy.
Absolutely. Caroline, you doing okay over there, buddy? Now, the listener at home can't hear this.
The exact way the earbuds got yanked out. Me that came up to the chin.
Crazy.
It's very vulnerable, but the way we record it when we record this on Zoom is it does not sound, we do not sound to each other the way it sounds to you right now, the listener. We're hearing each other through our various computer microphones, speakers, and then audio run through headphones. So for Caroline, she is wearing her Apple earbuds and her microphone is attached. And for maybe, this was cut out, but maybe for half the episode last week, it was just underwater under her shirt or something because she had the other earbud attached to her ear.
Like the little microphone that like TikTokers bring up to their mouth when they talk and narrate things. I forgot that was a working component of the whole situation.
Which is odd given the TikTok exposure in your life.
Yeah, and my audio engineering that I've been really working on in this pandemic.
I was going to say congrats on getting your master's on that, by the way.
Thank you. It was a certification, but I'll take the promotion. That's nice.
Hey, University of Phoenix is nothing to sneeze at. Jeff, thanks so much for joining us on the show.
My hometown.
Oh, is that true?
Yeah.
Well, then let's start there. How'd you grow up Christian, religious, spiritual in Phoenix?
Yeah, well, I think one of the reasons I like your pod so much, as I was telling y'all offline, this is the only happy podcast in my feed. I'm a little too goth when it comes to my podcast choices, I guess. Or maybe it's just goth times. And one of the differences for me, and I think it's like an anthropological interest, like an academic interest in this Christian pop culture that I kind of missed out on. I found Christian faith on my own, sort of separate from family upbringing, with my, you know, really premature existential crisis at like age 13. Whoa. And so I didn't, you know, get all the just mind-blowing focus on the family type shit that y'all poor people got. And so I sort of got to pick and choose in my own way and sort of got to figure out my way of being a snotty obscurist, even when it came to the Christian material. And thus here we are with Pedro the Lion. Nice. And so I came to the church seeking the one place in Scottsdale, Arizona that held plausible claim to a place you could find God and find the hot chicks. And that was the Scottsdale Bible Church youth group.
That Venn diagram for you was that.
Yeah, it's a real bait and switch, though. I you know, once I found Jesus, I also signed up for the whole abstinence thing. So they got me.
I know. Yeah. And that's for life. I don't know if you knew.
It's a life.
I know you have children, but you will need to go ahead and get back on that train if you can.
Can you imagine? Oh my God!
No. We did it all surgically. No.
Oh, great! Oh, I'm so happy to hear that. And I was going to ask you about that.
Can I ask real quick? Were your parents religious at all? Like in their background at all, or sort of?
My mom was an extremely spiritual person and had a very strong connection to faith, and you know, didn't do a lot of labeling with it. And then my dad is a really legalistic fellow by nature and by nurture. But when I was a child, the only way that manifested religiously is we went to church quite consistently, like every Sunday, but we did not believe in anything in particular, and the church that we attended didn't seem to believe in much other than sort of moral teachings. And it was just sort of a really uninspiring experience for me as a child, and dicked around as much as possible, and it sort of seemed like that was fine with everybody until I found an expression of the faith that, you know, I think developmentally was exactly what I needed, even if it wasn't exactly a place, the evangelical church, a place I should have stayed for very long.
So developmentally, what needs did it fulfill for you at that time?
I think one of the ways that I conceptualize it is when things are really fucked up and you find something healthier, it's good. The risk, though, is defining less traumatic as healthy. Mm-hmm. And it is absolutely true that the evangelical church was a safer, healthier, more loving place than my home. But that does not mean that it was health. And I think that that's a space that gets a lot of us sort of frozen in amber in one stage of growth instead of, you know, trying to move on and look for what the next thing is. You know, Richard Rohr on that, you know, developmentally appropriate religion, I think that's a phrase of his, but it's certainly a theme of his. This idea that no, conservative religion is what a young mind needs developmentally. Black and white rules are appropriate for a young mind. But if you're doing that at middle age, there's a significant stunting of growth going on. And so, yeah, I think the last few years have been about unstunting.
Yeah, that's such an interesting idea too, that there is value. Caroline and I were having a discussion about even the theology of heaven and hell and whether that has any intrinsic value to it at all, because it does speak to the sort of black and white thing that you're talking about, that for a child, in a sense of pretty clear discipline, does maybe provide a structure that is understandable and manageable, that doesn't account for the nuance of the world, to say nothing of the theology that we do have to wrestle with later. So how long do you feel like that was useful for you? If you came to it, you said at age 13?
Yeah. And then, you know, stayed in that evangelical world for as long as I was in Phoenix until I went to college at 18 across the country in Chicago. Discovering that I was an artist in college and just having a really broad set of relationships, and that whole process had me moving away in college from an evangelical expression of the faith toward a reformed one. And the positives there, again, positives for growth, were a lot more activism, a lot more social involvement, a lot more of a outward facing faith that tries to act within the world rather than this inward, you know, have some holy beliefs set in stone that write your ticket. Again, I have compassion for that college age student who needed to grow in that way. But then I think the trick, the really tricky part for me was then, while that faith was more progressive, I think some of the psychological roots of the Reformed tradition are as fucked up as anything Christianity has to offer. You know, becoming a Calvinist basically for 15 years was a great way to play into the categories of shame that I got handed by my father and by some of my earliest forms. So it's real, real wonderful corkscrew effect that happened there until I chucked a, you know, a church life, what, about 4 years ago now, within a, you know, within a church that I've been a part of for 13, 14 years as a lay leader and on staff at various points in various positions, and just said, this is part of what I've got to deconstruct in order to grow.
I want to ask about the Calvinist theology relating to the stuff you got handed down psychologically from your parents, because I always think of it as the sort of caricature I feel like we go to often on this show is the kind of browbeating and like going up for the altar call and beating your chest and saying, I'm a worm, I'm very lowly, I have nothing good in me, it is only Christ in me. Was that the sort of thing that, because I'm wondering about kids who do, and adults that do find that stuff sort of affirming or validating in some sort of way, is that because it matched the sort of maybe psychology that your parents handed down to you?
Yeah, and I think I think it's less about theology or even psychology and more about, you know, habits of mind. I think shame was used as a tool in my family system, and that, you know, in the same way it's used in Calvinist theology and Calvinist churches in my experience, this idea of, you know, utter depravity. That you allude to with, you know, there's nothing good in me, zero. The way that allows for a really universalized shame that, you know, that classic differentiation between guilt and shame, you know, Brené Brown probably put it most famously of just guilt, I've done something wrong, shame, I am something wrong. You know, that lines up so neatly with the Calvinist philosophy that sort of on the other side of things of seeing, you know, becoming a practitioner, a therapist, and working a lot with shame, both in my client work that led me into my work as a therapist, which won't surprise you is very often the case. You know, a lot of it is just now about, as a practitioner, it's about what works. And when you take what works as a practitioner, you're going to reflect back on your theology, and it doesn't really hold, you can't hold that, I could no longer hold this tension of this faith system that speaks of love so often, but that propagates shame. And we just sort of like throw our hands up like, oh, weird coincidence that this has been happening for the 200 years of American evangelicalism. How strange. Oh, well, moving on. And it's at a certain point, if you believe in what works, you say, no, this theology propagates shame, which is love's relational opposite, and therefore it can't be love, and therefore it can't be right. It can't be correct.
So how did you end up reconciling those things?
Oh, yeah, I got it all worked out.
Yeah. You're arrived, right?
I am at the destination.
I really relate to that. It's so interesting to hear you just describe this from your... like vocational perspective. I know you have a lot of vocations, but like the idea of like what was developmentally what worked for me, and then when I realized that psychology deeply affects who you are as a person, and the psychology of what a person is also a part of religion, even though we think they're separate sometimes, you know, like, oh, you can be an evangelical Christian and then you can also practice like deep self-compassion, you know, and like all these things. And I think like that's probably why I feel maybe as like an ex-evangelical that like therapy replaces so much of like the function that religion had or that God had in like my self-identity or whatever, because like, yeah, they are kind of at odds, or they were at odds. And that's why things started to fray at some point in life when you couldn't hold the line anymore. And so it's just like it's profound to me even just to remember right now, like, oh, yeah. Any religion, and including Christianity, does have like a psychology aspect to it, even if they don't admit it or like aren't cognizant of it. Like it's deeply woven into what you think you are when you're worshiping God, which is huge. It's crazy.
Yeah, and I love the idea that you mentioned of like, you know, you can one be an evangelical and practice deep self-compassion? And I think the answer, obviously from experience, is yes. But I think the more complicated answer is, well, in the end, you didn't believe in any deep meaning of the word in the things you said you believed, because it would preclude all that.
Yeah, that's pretty wild, isn't it?
Well, we're all doing versions of that all the time, right? Like, no two of us mean the same thing when we say the word God, and that includes whatever purity culture churches I was a part of, where we all signed 20-page faith systems. You know, it's still the case that I'm standing there thinking of a different God than Joe is and than Martha is. You know, it sort of comes down to, I guess, questioning and re-questioning those categories.
I'm also interested, too, just how, kind of speaking to what Caroline said, there's probably so many people, and I don't even know if you specialize in this with your clients, but there's probably so many people that do find this, as far as therapy goes, looking for new systems. Because I think a commonality that Caroline and I share, too, as far as leaving that sort of church, is also missing some of that structural comfort that is value systems based. And that is, okay, here are the kind of guidelines and sort of boundaries, not the black and white stuff that does propagate that like sort of shame that we're talking about, but the sort of value systems that give us at least a little bit of a roadmap to navigate life. As a therapist, how have you found a corrective way to communicate those things that is not dogmatic or one size fits all?
Yeah. It always depends on the client. Yeah. I deal with a lot of folks, recovering from systems of abuse, including, religious trauma and shame. Those all go together. Trauma and shame are, you know, if not siblings, step siblings. I think a huge part of the way I interact with this, you know, you said sort of, you pointed out that the difficulty is you want to give guidance, but you also don't, you never want to become the guru. And then you also don't want to make something else the new sacred text. I really like the idea of dialogue. I really like the idea of, depending on the client and how I know them, recommending a couple books that come at the topic from different positions, or recommending, you know, certain podcasts that, you know, allow for
ours. Ours? Are we one of them?
Yeah, you guys just really need to listen to Audio Adrenaline get picked apart.
You never recommend our podcast? Wow. Wish I knew that before we booked you.
Caroline, I told you we should have done a more multi-level marketing system where every guest has to recommend the podcast to three people who didn't recommend it to three people.
I was foolish to say that
was too complicated. Well, let me be clear. I often recommend your podcast, but not to clients.
Yeah, no. Not for something that might lose your credentials potentially in a professional situation.
Well, Jeff, even like what you described, I feel like is a really good kind of rule of thumb to follow, depending on if you're figuring out like your mental health journey or like what church you like or what belief system you're into too, because what you were telling your client was like, here's some resources, but ultimately like the important thing is that you decide for yourself what you believe and like you practice your own like critical thinking and your own version of whatever works. And that's like, that's really key. And I don't know if that's always like intuitive or like given as an instruction in the churches that you're actually at. It might be a little bit more top down. This is what we believe. And you have like a little bit of wiggle room within that, you know?
Yeah. I think that's a great way to conceptualize the difference, right? Here's the answer, all caps.
Right.
Versus your job is to figure it out. Sorry.
Yeah. And it's going to be ultimately a lot better for you when you like do it, not because someone, you wanted to please someone or you wanted to fit in or whatever, but because it worked for you.
How do you find God useful in therapy at all as a figure? Because I know some, and I know you're not specifically a quote unquote Christian therapist or anything like that, but I am curious that, you know, in things like AA or Al-Anon, God does kind of persist, or whatever is the synonym for God or the higher power does persist in a lot of the structural import of those things. So where do you find, I feel like the way we've kind of been trending in our own lives is that we want God when it's useful and we want it when it's not or not loving. So when is God useful for you in therapy?
I think a lot of it comes down to speaking the same language as my clients, right? and I'll circle back to shame because it's the clearest example of when not to say something. Insight isn't a holy grail in therapy, you know. Freud and you know, still a very heavy hitter from the grave in the field. This idea that insight is sort of the end of things, whereas, you know, insight doesn't create change. Insight doesn't create growth on its own. It's an important step in the process. Likewise, with shame, if I have the insight that a client is in shame, it in a lot, maybe the majority, I don't know, but certainly a lot of the times when I sense that and I feel that and I can validate that clinically, it would actually be counterproductive and damaging to the work for me to name it. To name shame is often shaming. You know, I was really glad to come to therapy in a time, I mean, just, you know, I only started studying in 2017 and just put the pedal to the metal on my studies because I knew what I wanted to do. And I was glad to come to it in a place that even, you know, at, you know, a secular institution that we had begun in the field when educating new therapists to always talk about the spiritual dimension. And that's really new. It used to be something we ignored. And again, that's really Freudian. You know, Freud wrote a book called The Religion, The Future of an Illusion. And I'm so glad that we've returned to that. And what that means to me is that I will always conceive of all of us as spiritual beings. And that includes myself on my atheist days. And there are many. If the word God is part of the language for a client's spirituality, great. And if the word yoga or the word breathwork or the word love or the word connection is instead the language for this same thing, or that might debase the concept a little bit to call it the same thing. But if those other terms are a better road in to the spiritual dimension of a client, so be it. Spirituality is something I talk about no less with clients who identify as atheists than with clients who identify as Christians or Buddhists or Zoroastrianists.
Wait, what was that last one?
I was just grasping. Zoroastrianism, it's...
There are many folks the Mask of Zorro movie with Catherine Zeta-Jones.
Yeah, that one. Yeah, you got it.
Banderas.
Yeah, not any of the previous iterations of Zorro, but just the 1997 movie.
Wait, Kev, I gotta know, did you nail the year? Was it actually 97?
It might be 98.
Might have. Okay,
let me Wikipedia it. I'm on the case.
You might have. You're right near it.
What the like scaffolding of your brain is like?
It's 98.
Oh man, that was the middle of high school for me. He's right.
Dang it! Almost. Good grief. Well, you said you have atheist days too. So I would just kind of want to conclude this part of the show by asking, what is God to you today?
I think I've gotten out of that crisis of, and I think a lot of this is dispensing with hell, right? I've gotten out of that crisis of, oh no, what if I don't believe in God today and this is the day I'm taken? I don't want to dismiss, I do think it's hilarious, and yet I don't want to dismiss that, you know, letting go of that fear in a real embodied way, like it actually being gone is a big part of the freedom. I find myself wanting to apologize for the esoteric version, but it's the only version for me. It's that we are meaning-making machines. It's what defines our species. We're storytellers. I'm a storyteller by trade. I've been a narrative artist my whole life, and a huge school of therapy is narrative therapy. It's retelling your story. So we're meaning-making machines. Stories are thus about the most important thing we've got. A lot of days, maybe most days, I'm convinced God is a metaphor. And yet, that does not reduce my faith or the importance, because metaphors are really fucking important when you're meaning-making machines and story has this high value. And so, you know, I can put myself in the shoes of my former, quote, orthodox self or my dad or whatever guardian of the orthodoxy hearing that and sort of feel that condemnation, and these days I'm just kind of like meh.
Sips his tea. I mean, how well put.
I like that, though. I like.
Yeah. You just record that in a voice memo. Loop yeah. it 10 times and I can listen to it as I go to sleep. Just how well
there you go.
Yeah. Yes, and and thankfully we're recording video too, so we can make that a GIF as well. available for a low cost in the GCF online store.
The MLM that we're running. That's so lovely, and I like appreciate you saying that, because that will be helpful to me, I think, on my atheist days, which are now probably more than my faithful days at this point in life. But yeah, that like the metaphor or whatever, just because I can still stand outside of it and be like, well, this might not be even real. If I acknowledge that like the metaphor is still deeply important to me as a human being, then like that's still good. And that's valid in itself. Yeah.
And I'm more and more connecting to the power story. Again, on a what works level, right? Like when I find myself recommending books, it's like sometimes they're written by therapists or scientists, but and sometimes they are, but that's not the important part. Like what makes Brené Brown such a big deal is her connection to story and her ability to share her own story, or to be able to talk with women about body shame, body trust, and be like, yeah, you should read Jamie Lee Finch's book. Not because I agree with every single thing, but the power of that story is that's the juice. That's the thing. Mm, well, did you guys have her on?
We did.
We did.
Yeah, I need to listen to that one. She's great.
She was one of our last in-person records of 2020. Oh,
that's right. Yeah.
Oh,
she was great.
That's sad.
Yeah, she was very, very lovely. And I enjoy her in the 50 Shades of Grey trilogy. Just kidding. She looks a lot like Dakota Johnson.
Yeah, totes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Jeff, thank you so much for sharing all that, man. I really appreciate it. And especially the perspective from a therapy, therapy person is what I almost said. You know, a therapy person.
That's what I am, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, before I hang myself by my words anymore, let's take a short break and we'll be right back with more good Christian fun. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Now, Caroline, I got a question for you.
Yes.
How is your social battery right now? Are you feeling drained? Do you got a lot of energy right now? Where are you at with things as we speak today?
Well, you know, when you're pregnant, famously, your social battery is endless, actually, because you're powered by a baby battery.
It's like someone slaps a mag charger onto your phone.
Exactly.
And you can go for like 24 hours more.
I am the U.S. Marines of... taking down social situations. I feel incredible all the time. So yeah, that's where I'm at. What about you?
Wow. Well, I'm feeling a little drained. And sometimes it can be easy to ignore our social battery and spread ourselves too thin, which is maybe the zone I'm in right now. Mm. And for me, spreading myself too thin is like going to a lot of like Garfield events recently that have been happening over town.
Oh,
with
yeah.
The new movie coming out.
I know you get so excited about those. You got to spread those out a little more.
I know. And I need to really protect my energy and stuff. But, you know, it's worth asking ourselves, what's the right amount of socializing and how do you recharge? Maybe you thrive around people. Maybe you need a little me time, a little alone, introverted time. But either way, therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. So things like tuning into yourself, feeling and understanding what you want and need yourself, and then being able to communicate that to those around you, and then most especially to yourself.
Well, if you can't get pregnant immediately, that sounds like a pretty good solution as a backup.
And again, I think I might have even said this before. If I could get pregnant, I would, just to understand what it's like to have even like boundless energy that
right.
can kind of propel me into
feel
like
as incredible as you could feel.
To exercise more, mm-hmm. to be working out like 3 hours a day.
Exactly.
Working 9 hours a day on top of that, and then
good
going out 2 hours. Yes, such a good brain on top of that. So if you're thinking about starting therapy, maybe give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. All you have to do is fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. If you don't like the first person you get, don't worry, there's another one on the docket. So find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/goodchristianfun today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
10%?
.com/goodchristianfun. You got some thoughts on that 10%?
That's a good deal.
It is. I agree.
Month?
And especially because 10% is where I'm feeling my battery is right now. That's betterhelp.com/goodchristianfun.
This HeadGum Podcast is brought to you by Aura Frames.
That is right.
From grandmothers to new mothers. Aunts, even the friends of your life, every mom loves an Aura Frame.
Holy shit, even aunts?
Yes, especially aunts.
Oh, well.
Because it was named the best digital photo frame by Wirecutter and selected as one of Oprah's favorite things. I mean, these Aura Frames are guaranteed to bring joy to moms of all ages.
I believe it.
You have an Aura Frame, don't you?
Yes, I actually more than believe it. I know it. I've got one for my mom, my mother-in-law, my grandmother-in-law.
And dare I say, your aunt?
And dare you say, my aunt and my aunt-in-law. Everyone's got one. Everyone loves them.
I mean, Mother's Day is right around the corner, and there's no better gift than a digital photo frame. You give them the frame. It's got preloaded pictures in there. And you know what? You can update it with an app. So every time you take a new picture of a sweet little person or place or thing in your life, it gets automatically sent to that frame.
Exactly.
And right now, Aura has a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. Holy smokes.
Excellent deal.
Yeah, that's AuraFrames.com. You use the code HEADGUM at checkout to save.
HEADGUM. Nice.
Yes. HeadGum. It's easy to set up. It's loved by everybody, including Oprah, including your aunt.
Mm-hmm.
So do check them out. That's AuraFrames.com. Use code HeadGum at checkout to save.
Damn right.
And terms and conditions apply, of course.
Of course.
Thanks again to Aura.
Welcome back to Good Christian Fun. It's time for Singles Ministry. Should it be a different song, Caroline?
Why? Why would it
I don't
be a
know.
Song?
It's just literally, it's such a first thought, like, okay, single lady. It's such a first thought idea.
No, it's good.
Like,
it's like an energy booster. It's fun. People now are thinking about Beyonce. They're thinking about dancing. And that's kind of the mm-hmm. the headspace we want them to come in.
But then is it like, is it not, if it's not additive, if I'm not doing like a full parody song on top of the instrumental track, is it valueless as a theme song?
Well, Kevin, that's something you're going to have to think about as you fall asleep tonight, my friend, and I can't help you with that.
Now, what if you wrote a parody song? That might be kind of fun.
Okay, I'll write a parody song.
You would do it. Okay. This is Singles Ministry. This is where we take one song from one artist and we talk about it for the entirety of the segment. Usually we do albums, but this time we're just doing one song. We've done it before. We did it with What If I Stumble by DC Talk. We did it with Angels by Amy Grant. And today we're doing it with Almost There by Pedro the Lion. Not from Napoleon Dynamite, Caroline. But before we get into Pedro the Lion, I would love, Jeff, to hear about generally your background with Christian music. Now, you said you came at it from a different angle than a lot of the stuff that we've talked about before that might air on the side of contemporary radio and the pop stuff. You might be more into the ska, tooth and nail, MXPX scene.
Yeah. Strong opinions, Kev. Strong opinions. Like, my teenage self is just like, okay, listen.
I'll bring him out. We'd love to talk to him.
Hear it.
First off, fuck East Coast ska.
I didn't know there was East Coast ska. Truly, this is
The Boston's were Boston.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the Christian scene, I'm trying to remember the name of like the one East Coast ska band.
The Insiders.
Yep.
Was it them? Okay,
it was
great.
The New York Supertones.
I did not like them.
New York Supertones.
Yeah, I had strong opinions about it, and yeah, I think it was an interesting thing for me to come to. Like, I was a kid in Phoenix, Arizona, who was mostly hanging out with athletes and evangelical Christians, and you know, you put all that together, and I'm not going to have the deepest access to obscure music, and so it sort of looked like I'm pretty cool because I listen to Weezer's Pinkerton, not the Blue Album, right?
Right. So a popular band, second album instead of, the most popular. Yes.
That's really quirky.
Right. Yeah. Like what that meant, like moving into the Christian music was Tooth and Nail Records, late 90s, the hardcore bands, a little bit of the singer-songwriter stuff. you know, the distinction of having the first Danielson Family Records, Danielson Family being, you know, this amazing place where art rock got made. The story of that first record is such a cool art school thing, and the way that, you know, that became a jumping off point for Sufjan, and then Sufjan Stevens, and then how Sufjan, you know, the way that Sufjan Stevens played in the Danielson band happened with St. Vincent, and the way that she mm-hmm. sort of became this megastar after being associated with Sufjan, and that whole dynamic that gets explored in what's it called, the documentary about Danielson, sounds familiar, I think it's called. Just this angst of like being the father figure and the artsy fartsier one, but your creative progeny is on this meteoric rise. And so having this sort of musical awakening through Christian music I actually liked, probably heaviest with like Five Iron Frenzy, and then into sort of Tooth and Nail stuff and hardcore stuff, and then sort of going off to college and becoming a real obscurist, and having my own radio show and doing, you know, actual underground rock and underground jazz. And
you were a DJ, sir.
Oh my goodness.
I was a DJ at WNUR, Chicago's Sound Experiment.
Okay,
that should have been like three chapters of your guestimony, you know, of the DJ years. I would have liked to know.
I mean, there was a time there I was going to six shows a week because I was booking shows at the clubs I liked the most. And I was like, why wouldn't I go? I can just call up and get on the list. And yeah, it was just such a great time. And during that time, I actually, between summers, I interned at Tooth and Nail Records.
Was this when they were in Washington?
Yeah. This
Fellas,
when they were in Seattle.
I don't know what Tooth and Nail is, and it sounds like it's going to come up a lot.
Listen, so I would just okay, like Caroline. To Tooth and Nail Records, it's a Christian rock record label. Mm. It started in 1993. They moved to Seattle, where it's still there to this day. They got acts like Under Oath, our beloved Hawk Nelson, Imri, The Almost, Family Force 5, and Berlin, MXPX. And maybe Pedro the Lion as well.
Yes. Okay. Thank you. Now I know. Yes. I know the vein you're talking about now a little bit. Okay.
You even if you don't know it, you know it. And mm-hmm. so I got there in an interesting time where they were moving from being like a real passion project and a bunch of hardcore bands and stuff that's hard to market to just the decision of, okay, every artist we're gonna play, we're gonna be able to market them as the Christian version of blank. And so It was definitely a period of shifting, and the record at hand today is an interesting part of that shift. Right then, at the beginning of the 2000s, they were still getting these folks that kind of came through, I think, because, oh, hey, you guys got Danielson Family, Pedro the Lion, and then, like, Damian Jurado's first record was, like, co-put out by Tooth and Nail and Sub Pop, that milieu being the Cornerstone Christian Music Festival. You guys know about this?
R.I.P. Yeah. Yes, we have talked about Cornerstone.
Yeah, and going to that and sort of those days of like, I only went to it once, and it was sort of, you know, on this interesting trajectory that you know, the Christian, the underground Christian music scene that was really centered in the Pacific Northwest was really mirrored by that festival of a lot. The one year I went, where a summer where I was really getting this vibe of this transition at Tooth and Nail toward, okay, we're a business now, we're adults now. A lot of the bands that I liked were just like, this is our last year playing this Cornerstone thing. And so I saw those groups there, and Damian Jurado and Pedro the Lion played in each other's sets. It was kind of this goodbye. And the song at hand was always one that Pedro the Lion would never play live, because the literal shout out to his hardcore roots of that, the hardcore singing in moments of the song. And he wouldn't play it live because, you know, shouting is hard on your vocal cords. Do you guys know?
Oh.
Yeah.
We know from our live shows, and we've since corrected.
That's why we only do one a year. It's a recoup after all the shouting.
That's right.
It was like this moment of like the last time for everybody. And the, here's that song you kids always ask me for, damn it.
And yeah, that was a lot of talking, guys.
No, that's good. That was a little mini history of TNN at the time, because I was into Five Iron as well, which I think was 5 minute walk records. It wasn't Tina.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
But just, I feel like such a, and I know this doesn't natively interest Caroline, but just all this like the DJ lore and like this label was doing this, but they wanted to go this way, and so I find all that stuff so fascinating because all those changes now are not dictated at that level. It's like so many like self-starters. It's kind of like what happened with movies in a way. Can I talk about that for a second, Caroline?
You can but talk just, about whatever you want, Kevin.
Just in the sense of like there used to be a lot of $30, $40, $50 million movies that were like mid-budget dramas for adults. And then those have like slowly gone away that they're only Netflix movies now. And then it's like $200 million Marvel movies, franchise movies, Fast and Furious, Star Wars movies, and then like $2 million indies that might break through. And that's kind of what music's become in a lot of ways too. Like you can't really rely on the support of like a mid-tier label that might put it out. It's either your Columbia or Bandcamp is kind of what it feels like now. And the, and that goes for Christian artists
too. The shrinking
too.
Middle class of music.
There you go. Okay. Caroline found an in.
My economic theory that I also don't know anything about.
Gracious. So David Bazan, he also is based in Seattle, Washington. He lives out there. And so Pedro the Lion is essentially him. It's kind of like a moniker, the way Bon Iver is Justin Vernon, even though there's been other guys in the band. But there was a band that started in the 1990s. This EP, he recorded all the instruments himself. So everything you hear on this is him doing it and tracking it. And then there were a few other people. Then he restarted it. This is a trend too, interestingly enough, with like some rock bands of the rock band will exist, it'll disband, and then whoever the front person was will do their solo stuff. And then if that isn't quite hitting the way they need it to, they will restart the band name.
Your origin even, band.
Yeah, even if it is just essentially a solo project now. So you kind of see that with like Ezra Koenig's last Vampire Weekend record was kind of just like an Ezra Koenig record with Vampire Weekend featuring. And certainly the new Killers album is like that, where it's basically a Brandon Flowers project that he's just using the Killers name. So Pedro the Lion's doing that too. And he was one of those guys who's kind of supposed to inherit like the kind of contemporary Christian music thing of like, yeah, it's like a evangelical thing and you're going to have altar calls at your shows and stuff. He's like, no, I'm not interested in that. There's a great book called Body Piercing Saved My Life, Inside the Phenomenon of Christian Rock by Andrew Bajan that talks about some of this stuff and kind of the crossroads he was at. He was part of a hardcore punk band called The Guilty, which is where you kind of hear some of the screaming on the song we're listening to today, kind of rooted in that. And then that kind of transition, which once we get into the song, we can read a little bit from that. So let's listen to the song now just for a little bit. It's a brisk 309 and it's called Almost There from the whole EP from 1997. So that's a brief snippet. It's a pretty lyrically sparse song. Well, we've just played 2/3 of the lyrics in the song. The second verse being, the chances are slight that I won't shoot up tonight, but the sensation that's weighing beneath is a kick in the teeth, and then plays the chorus a few more times. So this is explicitly about heroin. But I was curious to see if for you, Jeff, and then you, Caroline, listening to it for the first time, if it felt more metaphorical than that, or if it did feel like a literal, yeah, this is just about addiction stuff, or like the connection to God in that.
I think so much of listening to music that meant something to me two decades ago is about picking up that new pair of lenses. And a huge part of my picking up a new pair of lenses on this side of my life is the therapeutic one. Like, I find so much of the music I used to listen to embarrassing, and that includes songs on this record. It does not include this song. I think that's partly because the course of it's on the tip of my tongue. As a clinician and as a person with so much addiction in his family, I think it's such a beautiful, and there's so much pathos in that description of chasing, you know, the addict behavior of chasing that dragon.
Mm-hmm. Totally. And it is kind of shocking. I think it's easy to say, this is our first song we've talked about on the show that's about heroin addiction. There's not a lot of Stephen Curtis Chapman songs about heroin addiction.
Very few.
That he's put out. They might be in the vault, but we have not heard them yet. Yes. And those
I'm sorry. I need you to catch me up. Has he said that there is a vault?
Oh, I'm sure there's some sort of vault. No, I just assume with any
if you're going out there saying there's a vault, you're basically saying I'm Prince. And I need to have a fight with you.
I assume with any prolific musician over the course of decades that there's going to be some sort of vault. Although I was having a conversation today with a friend about maybe vaults are going away. And isn't that interesting? We'll do a second service about that. Caroline, I know you're jazzed to hear about it. It has to do with streaming numbers and the algorithm, and people don't hold back anything so they can... verse one is, at least in my dreams when I'm sleeping, it seems that the needle is full endlessly, but you keep on waking me. The chorus is, I'm almost there. It's on the tip of my tongue and it never goes away. It never comes to stay. I found that to be a pretty powerful couplet to describe what addiction probably feels like, or to like transmute it to other people's experiences. Any sort of lingering anxiety or thorn in your side as far as something that threatens your happiness or your joy. Like, it never goes away and never comes to say, where it's like, well, I didn't have a panic attack and wreck my car today, but it doesn't mean that I didn't feel like I was about to, like, most of the time when I was driving. I felt that to be a pretty vivid depiction of that.
Yeah, it's so well put. Like, kind of like a low simmering agony is in, like, this whole song.
So from the book, Body Piercing Saved My Life, I just wanted to read this part. They were talking about the whole EP in general, and Andrew writes, it takes less than 15 minutes to go from the kid who decided speaking in tongues was bullshit to the one who wanted to go to heaven without dying. Hole is a remarkably detailed snapshot of Bazan's evolving trademark confliction. Interestingly, he chooses to express what he sees as the growing incompatibility of his two goals, being a good Christian and living by his own code, through the lens of heroin addiction. Bazan is in character when he sings, the chances are slight that I won't shoot up tonight. He hasn't tried heroin, but if you want to understand junkies, that's kind of an interesting way to put it. If you want to understand junkies, you could have done worse than being a hipster in Seattle in the early 90s. A buddy's girlfriend had been a heroin addict for a long time, Bazan told me. And she stopped doing it for a couple years. Then out of nowhere, she ran into an old buddy. It was a good fit, and she got tangled up for it in another year. It just seemed like such a tragedy, something that is always with you. You're always susceptible to falling into the same thing, he continued. I just felt a parallel, like it's not possible for me to habituate the virtue the way I want to. It's this endless cycle of failure that I can't break out of. So for him personally, heroin was an analogy for whatever the virtue lack is, or the thing that even like Paul talks about, like, I know what the thing is and I don't do it, and I know what the thing I don't want to do is and I do it, and that sort of thing. That I think even outside of a evangelical or reform lens that maybe would resonate with some people, the idea of like, it feels like I keep screwing this up and I'm not quite there and it's always there. And I even find some resonance with it in the sense of living in LA for 11 years now, 10 regular years, one pandemic year, so maybe 10 years. But just thinking to marking my time with church when I did get here and attending another church and then attending different churches over the years, thinking that the problems I would have would be different as I gradually matured over time. So, okay, I'm going to deal with this from like 20 to 23. I'll graduate from that. And then there will be these new problems that are actually more interesting and complicated. I'll graduate from that. And then there'll be these even more complex problems. And the truth of the matter is the things that were happening when in 2010 and 2011, as far as like vice and virtue goes internally, some of those things are different, but much of it is the same. And most of those things are still kind of floating. They never stay. They never quite go away, but always kind of exist as this like looming threat to my happiness.
And what are those specifically?
Okay, yeah. Interesting. Now, I'm glad you asked that, and I actually did type them up, and they're in the show notes for the listeners to read at their own leisure, because it's a long document. It's pretty heavy.
Buckle up. Oh, man. Yeah.
Yeah, I like the idea of a show notes, just infinite scroll. It's like, what?
Yeah.
I'm on Twitter now? It just keeps going.
Today's show notes is technically an ebook. How do these ideas strike you, Caroline? Does this feel like more I'm a worm chest beating, or does this feel like a more complicated depiction of it?
Well, I didn't know this was about heroin. I didn't have all that background. And so it kind of felt to me like this song could be interpreted really broadly and be really beautiful on like various contexts, or this song, you could love it in a totally different way if you knew a lot about the singer and his life and like what brought him to this stage in life. And if he was kind of an in-between person and in faith, or if this is just like about his family or like whatever it could be. I don't know. It strikes me as like really sparse, really sad, and also surprising with the yelling. And I just didn't know I was going to hear a screamo kind of song.
Do you want to play that part?
I don't want to be flippant about it, but I thought it was cool too, because like the song is so quiet and subtle for a while too. But it makes sense hearing a little bit more about what you said and Jeff, what this meant for you too. And like that it would turn into like, yeah, like screaming rage, because it is like a ball of like addiction or confusion or slavery to something that you wouldn't want to be involved in is would make you want to yell.
Now, Jeff, we often refer to this encyclopedia called the Encyclopedia of Contemporary Christian Music by Mark Allen Powell.
Oh my God. I cannot believe that's a real book.
Oh, it's real and it's spectacular.
I think it's the DSM of CCF. Oh.
Hey!
That's how I think of it.
I want to see how much you would concur or agree with Powell's description of the genre. Pedro the Lion is one of Christian music's most outstanding and critically acclaimed indie bands. Their style is usually classed as emo or sometimes as indie folk rock, but the band is nothing if not distinctive. A typical Pedro album, if there is such a thing, features thoughtful story songs related in the first person to haunting and mostly acoustic instrumental riffs. Words like hypnotic and mesmerizing occur frequently in reviews.
Love it.
Yeah?
I mean, I don't know. Labels, man. Man, labels.
Bro.
Right?
Like, it's always so hard. Like being in the music world and thinking it was going to be my career and just being deeply invested in it.
What did you want to do in it, like, as a career full time?
Well, I didn't. I was thinking about engineering stuff. I played in bands. I was a drummer. Yeah, I just loved it. I think it always gets tricky when it's like, well, what does indie mean? Does that mean on an independent label? Because it's certainly what we meant when we were talking about it. But yeah, okay, I acknowledge that. You know, it's sort of the sound of a really old only 3-piece drum set and. And, you know, a specific Stratocaster and, you know, like, okay, I acknowledge that. But yeah, I mean, I found that far less idiotic than I expected, Kevin.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I don't know this guy's background. I'm other than he's like a professor somewhere, but he's pretty even keeled with only some.
Who is it?
A guy named Mark Allen Powell. Mark Allen
Powell. Oh, he's brilliant. I've never read anything by him about music, but he has a book on the historical Jesus that's very, very good.
Jesus as a figure in history and narrative criticism?
Yep.
Yeah. 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 Nice. Hey. Wow. Nice. Jeff. The credentials on display. There's a documentary called Strange Negotiations about David Bazan.
And I really want to watch it. People talk about it. And I love him in interviews and sort of all, I love him on Twitter. And he's just such a thoughtful guy. And his playing with Christianity like a cat with a toy. You know, I am, I'm not. Fuck you and your labels. All the above over 20 years. I love it.
Yeah, and he's definitely someone like, as kind of a standard of comparison, Caroline, maybe like a less annoying Derek Webb. And someone who definitely is like NPR co-signed, right? Like, so like music outlets and stuff that exists, like Pitchfork or NPR still kind of herald his stuff. He's done a Tiny Desk concert a couple years ago. Like, he's still kind of in the mix of like, oh, this is one of the best lyricists of the 90s and aughts. So it's still in the conversation.
Yeah, the record's got extremely strong. Mm-hmm. This record is, you know, really uneven. And the song I accidentally emailed you, you know, sings a lot about a Jesus-shaped hole. Let's be honest.
No, the refrain of that song is, can you fix me, hole fixin' man?
Hole fixin' man.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, he's telling you that there's some self-irony there, but
yeah.
A lot of inconsistency that, like, by the time he was on, I think Winners Never Quit is probably the third full length, so mm-hmm. the fourth overall, things got really, really solid. And not just his songwriting, but his production and arrangement has been so, so good for a long time. And I agree with the assessment, Kevin, of just like, in that conversation, for not for a Christian, but as a person in the independent or underground music scene, one of the strongest, most consistent songwriters for such a long time, just cranking out records for two decades now.
Yeah, his last album, I took a little listen to Phoenix, and I really enjoyed that. That came out last year, and I really enjoyed that. So,
Jeff, why did you pick this song specifically, though? What did it mean for you then, and I guess what do you mean for you now?
I think I picked it because I had a really strong connection to how meaningful it was to me then, and I was deeply curious about how I would feel about it now. And the interesting moment of telling you the wrong song and listening to that and being like, okay, I told the wrong song, but I'm going to listen to this. And oh man, yeah, I am embarrassed by this. Am I going to be embarrassed by being a person who liked the right song? And then listening to the right song and be like, no, there's still a lot here.
Nice.
And yeah, I think for me is like an interesting moment that, you know, is a cultural, I guess I'll say a subcultural moment, right? Of where Christian music had been and where it was headed. And you know, the way I got to sort of dive, you know, parachute into that just by interning in one particular summer at Tooth & Nail and going to Cornerstone with the Tooth & Nail folks. It was an interesting moment in my life. And I love the idea of the way these roads diverge, of thinking of like what I alluded to earlier, like, you know, the way that Danielson shepherded these people who became fucking Sufjan and Saint, and then the same kind of pattern for Saint Vincent, and the way we can watch that through that documentary, and you bringing up this documentary, Kevin, the same way these parallel lives of David Bazan, Pedro the Lion, and Damian Jurado, who were friends in the same scene, making similar music. And then I don't know if you guys were, you know, cognizant of this thing that happened to Damian Jurado's music. His second full length with this, you know, beautiful, beautiful song. Man, what is the name of the song? Doesn't matter. Let's just put it on. I'll sing every lyric. It got sampled, not by Moby, but by somebody almost as big as Moby, like 8 years ago, which places it like 15 years after the fact of recording. And because of that sampling, Damian Jurado, 15 years after the fact, became a person in this world who can make a living making this kind of music. And just like all the stuff that, you know, the state of the music business and the way it's shifted, and the way I've seen it with my friends who are still in bands, the ones that became very successful and have stayed there, but even that shifts. And then the ones who have been making great music that I love, but but, you know, I've never been able to make a living because that's just not how it works anymore. I dig it, and I find it like a reflection on fate and luck and beauty and the way that roads go. And I think it's an interesting moment for me just because, you know, the way it was like the last moment for Tooth and Nail for me, well, it was for him too. Yeah. So that's a really, really bad long answer, but words.
That was a great answer. Come on.
Yeah.
So many words, guys. So many words. Got to get the editor on that one.
Listen, well, I will say, I think it is time to give the song a rating, a roast or a toast. So, holy toast, we're going to give it a thumbs up and say,
yeah.
Holy roast, we give it a thumbs down and say,
no.
Or we give it the space between.
The space between.
Is there a Christian Dave Matthews band?
Oh, I am sure that Tooth and Nail Records higher ups in 2004 could absolutely answer that question.
Okay, well, we'll Google it later. Caroline, we'll start with you.
It's going to be a toast for me. I enjoyed this song. I thought musically it was really pretty. And yeah, the lyric writing was really good. It was a lot more subtle of a song than I thought it was going to be than our normal fare that we cover on this show, too. And I really appreciated that. And I appreciate that there was like a Christian or faith adjacent artist that was like, I don't know, talking about a real addiction that even if they were playing a character that was happening to them instead of like some poor person out there that needs Christ, you know,
and it's like not a fallen woman song. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. It was like really personalized, which I appreciate too. So that's my long winded toast.
All right. We'll turn to Jeff for his rating.
Yeah, man, I got to toast it. Yeah. This one's for the Jeff of the year 2000 who liked some good music.
Ah,
I will say it's very, it can be very validating to like the same artist over a long period of time and to be able to revisit it and not only not feel embarrassed, but almost to kind of feel rewarded for the experience and to have something age super, super well like that, or that the lyrics kind of like ground down deeper inside of you. So I'll give it a toast too. I thought it was like so wonderful and evocative. And I remember back when we like first started doing this show back in 2017, just kind of not knowing that much about other parts of this Christian music world and listening, walking around Portland, Oregon and listening to this EP specifically. Oh. And just kind of the feel. I remember the streets I was walking on when I was listening to some of these songs.
Oh, Kevin, I'm so glad that you had a history with this record. I would not have, I mean, this isn't a statement about you. It's a statement about the obscurity of the record. Wow.
Yeah, no, I was, you know, and I'm very grateful for that. And also on that trip, I was listening to Danielson Family as well with a friend of mine. So that was a pretty rich time. But yeah, I do like, kind of like as you pointed out, Caroline, in terms of like, it's not just putting it on someone else or fictionalizing it with a degree of distance that makes you unaccountable, but it's literally like the kind of formula of so many fallen woman or fallen boy songs we've talked about on this show, but then having the decency to recognize like, oh, that's also you. Like, you're not different from that. So what does it mean to kind of like own that and then walk in those shoes in a way that might increase your empathy? So I like it a lot. And
you're making
me
emotional.
What's that?
You're making me emotional.
Oh, that's very sweet. But yeah, I want to watch that documentary too because I like everything I've seen.
Hey, Netflix party watch. Well, I'm sure it's not on Netflix, but
it is on Amazon Prime to rent for $3.99. It looks like
the low price.
low price. So, all right, unanimous holy toast. Did not think it was going to go this way. TBH.
Really?
No. Well, when someone screams, I'm not like, Caroline would love this. To be frank.
I'm just like, whoa.
Yeah, I should have really gone for it. I should have gone with, you know, like, Stretch Armstrong or Zao. Or
you know, don't test me,
Monument,
Jeff.
Some of the real hardcore stuff from what?
You don't want to test me. You don't want to push me too far.
This is Stretch Armstrong. This is a song called Onward Christian Soldiers. Do you like this, Caroline?
Onward, Christian soldier.
All right.
Boy, thank you for sparing me.
Jeff was very kind in his pick. Okay. But we're not the final word on this. You can also give it a roast or toast on at Christian Fun Pod. So get out there and
Pokemon go to the polls.
I'm gonna shoot him in the leg instead of in the heart.
And let's do push-ups together, man.
And that second black woman, it me.
That was Joe Biden saying,
"Do we get the new candidates on there?
Let's shoot him in the leg instead of the heart. I'll do push-ups with you, man." And then Maya Rudolph is Kamala Harris saying, "It me."
Getting the Dem ticket on the drop. Ooh, thank you, Kevin.
Ooh, baby. Okay, time to bring it down. If that didn't bring it down enough already. Jeff, we're not here to promote ourselves or to plug our own projects. We're here to lift them up to the Lord as a loving and humble sacrifice. And we'll start with Caroline for that.
You can lift me up to the Lord at Caroline's Farts. And I can't wait to do this lift up. And I can't wait for the shock in Kevin's eyes as I lift up a superhero show that I've been enjoying called Doom Patrol. It's really, really fun and I like it. And I think it's really cool. And Jeff, I don't know if you may like it because they do actually talk about mental health surprisingly often on this show. And there's a character named Jane who has like multiple personalities, but those are her powers too that like have all protected her since she was like a little girl. And it's really beautiful. and
so Caroline, by recommending it to me, you obligate yourself to give me your HBO Max password.
Jeff, I'd love to give you my HBO Max
Caroline,
password.
Caroline! No, this is messed up, Jeff. It's my HBO Max password.
I'll make you a fresh profile. We'll all get all set up. It's really good. I like it. It's also just very stupid and silly a lot of the time, too, and great. So
terrific. Well, we'll turn it to... Wait. Okay, we'll turn it to Jeff.
I finished a book that's now out about my own spiritual deconstruction that I novelized because I need the safe distance of being able to tell folks, no, that's not real. It's fiction. And also because I'm a storyteller and I need to be able to make things up. Yeah, swimming in those waters again and again in the editing process and now in recording the audiobook of it has been really interesting to look back on a thing that you wrote a year ago and to see where you are now. And I think it's a huge part of the way I'm experiencing Breaking Bad and all the other stuff that I'm rewatching because, you know, content deficit these days, guys.
TV will run out very soon. Wow.
That's Jeff, alarmist. It sounds like you're trying to incite a mob. Yeah.
Kevin's always a little alarmist about the industry, so...
The sky is falling, Caroline!
I'm sure on some level it is true that movies will never be the same from when you were a kid or whatever, but...
They won't. Yeah. Yeah, Jeff, where can people get your book?
Yes.
So it is called Shame Baseball. You're not going to find more than one book named Shame Baseball. And the publisher is Wipf and Stock. Also not going to find more than one publisher with Wipf, W-I-P-F in the title. It is, of course, available on Amazon. And then whenever soon, probably by the time this comes out, I'll have the audiobook ready. And honestly, you could just put my email in the show notes and people can email me for the audiobook so that I can... cut out other parties on that transaction.
Wow.
Sure. Hey, nice. How about that?
How about that? A little pipeline for the... Hey, that's a little perk for the GCF listener that you won't there get anywhere else. You're
exclusive.
Welcome.
And then you can follow Jeff at Jeff Newberg everywhere.
Yeah, you can just DM me.
Yeah, DM!
Slide on in there, guys.
I love a plug that's just like, my DMs are open. Let's go.
let's make a deal. Name your price.
I guess.
Yeah, man. I'm open. Oh, thank you, Jeff. Well, you can lift me up at Kevin T. Port everywhere. I don't have anything left up this week. I've just been too present in the moment to really be consuming a lot
doing
of
doing too
content.
Many walks and spitting out. Have you guys heard of the outdoor spaces called parks?
All right.
And that's where I've been spending a lot of time.
I've been going there and they're good.
They are good.
Yes. But I'm not going to dox myself and tell you which ones on mic. But maybe later. I'll lift up parks.
Just email Kevin week. And he'll tell you.
I'll tell you and then we can meet up and then have cookies or whatever. You can lift us up at Christian Fun Pod everywhere. You can go to patreon.com/goodchristianfun for more good Christian fun, and you can leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. And we donate dollars to charity for every review you leave. And this month's charity is Black Lives Matters Charities. Jeff, thank you so much for joining us on the show, man.
Oh, thank you so much, guys. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Yeah, that's very sweet. And, you know, to turn the tables on you a little bit, that's our time today.
All right.
Our time is up.
Oh, man, already?
And there's nothing left to say, and except for, and all of Pod's people said, amen. Jeff, what is a Tooth and Nail or ska song or otherwise that you would like us to end the show on?
Oh, I'm going to go with Five Iron Frenzy and the way they connected to sort of the social ethic of Jesus that, you know, that gave me some hope in the church back in the day. You know, this band that had an audience within churches, and they sang a fair amount about indigenous issues. And so I think the title would be, the chorus is No Flag Flies, No Banner Waves. I think it's No Flag Flies.
This is Banner Year by Five Iron Frenzy.
Banner Year.
From our newest album ever. Hey, Reese is a friend. We love him. Thank you, Reese.
Wait, really?
Yeah.
Jeff, we talked to him.
He always seemed like the sweetest guy.
Yeah, he's a very good dude.
Talking over trumpets.
What'd you say? Okay, we
good
gotta
guy.
Go. Great guy, beautiful guy. Okay, we gotta go. We'll see you next week. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
That was a HeadGum podcast.